Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Almost everything occurs over Zoom these days. There is work meetings and family reunions and birthdays. So it should be no surprise that some people are turning to the Zoom platform to earn extra income, the side hustle, as it were. If you've got some experience or passion for teaching stuff, there's this new online learning platform called OutSchool, and it lets you teach any topic you want while generating some more money for yourself. Megan Tauber is going to be here to share her experience earning some money on the side using OutSchool. And the stock market never takes one simple, smooth, straightforward path. It just doesn't. It zigs, it zags, it's up, it's down. That will happen again this year and in the years to come. Tom Bradley is with Steady Hand Investment Funds, and he's going to take us through how to prepare for a down market, whether it comes tomorrow, in a month, in a year, in 5 years. And how to build a modern DIY stock portfolio. Keystone's Ryan Irving will be here to share his step-by-step. Plus, charitable giving trends for 2020 with Sona Kosla from a company called Benevity, and tax planning with John Waters at BMO Private Wealth. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. There was this song in the 1970s called Do the Hustle. It was used in schools to get us up and moving in the morning, like as a kind of like a mini workout or whatever. People of a certain age know exactly the song that I'm talking about. Dun, 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 dun. But the word hustle has taken on a whole new meaning in this gig economy that we're in, as in, what's your side hustle? Lots of people decide to take on another job to earn extra income or to pursue a passion. But how does that work in the virtual world of Zoom? Well, if you're an experienced teacher or experienced at teaching, an online learning platform called OutSchool allows you to do just that. Joining me now to share her experience teaching with OutSchool is Megan Tauber. She's in Austin, Texas today. Hello there.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I have an 11-year-old kid. OutSchool somehow found me on Facebook, and that is why you're here. Tell our listeners what this platform is and what it does.
So OutSchool is an online virtual learning platform. It is for ages 3 to 18 years old. It is super secure, and there are classes on there for everyone. So you can enroll your children in a semester-long core class, something like language arts or algebra or world history, SAT prep, or you can take kind of one-off classes on social clubs or Hamilton sing-alongs, improv, a love of Irish music, whatever. There is a class for everyone on there.
And what's your thing?
So I have two things, ironically. How lucky am I? When I first joined OutSchool, I decided to offer baking and cake decorating classes. I am a former bakery owner, and I thought, well, let me put this out there and see if there's any interest in it. And it turned out there was. There was lots of interest. And since then, that was about 3 years ago. Since then, I have helped hundreds and hundreds of amazingly talented kids fine-tune their technical skills in the world of baking, which is absolutely awesome. The other thing that kind of transitioned over the years is I am a history buff. You will find me in a historical museum, watching documentaries, reading history books, love, love, love history. And so I have started doing a world of social studies and history on OutSchool. For example, I lead a book club about World War II, and there are a lot of kind of teen and tween World War II aficionados out there, which is awesome. We have some great conversation in book club, but we talk about Churchill and his leadership style. We look at Eisenhower. We look at the attack on Pearl Harbor, D-Day, and we read books that are kind of immersed in that area.
We are coming to this from the perspective of personal finance. I want people to always be thinking about ways that they can get a better handle on their money and live the life they want. How much do you make? Is this enough to buy, you know, some extra ends for your cake icing kit? Or is this enough to buy the cake icing kit and a 3,000 square foot home with an outdoor kitchen and pizza oven?
So it's going to depend on how much you want to put into it, how many hours you want to work. And also it's going to depend on kind of the market that you teach, right? Some of the markets on OutSchool are more saturated than others. There's a million and one people doing watercolor painting, for example, or something like that, right? When I first started, I was the only one baking on OutSchool for the most part. And now there's a number of people that are doing that more. So it's going to depend on how many hours you want to work and how clever you are with marketing your classes and coming up with something unique that someone doesn't do. There are definitely people who are, you know, getting a little sprinkle of income and that's working for them. And there are definitely people who are using it as their sole source of income. It's not a side hustle. It's a full-time job for them. I fall somewhere in between. I started without school, for two reasons. Number one, I was hoping to cover the enrollment fees of my own children's classes on OutSchool because they started ramping up and I thought, oh, this wasn't in the budget. And so I thought, well, if I can teach and offset that, that would be awesome. The other goal that I had when I started was to put gas in the RV. We travel 4 or 5 months out of the year, and that is one heck of a gas bill. And so I thought, if I could just make a couple $1,000 a year to put gas in the RV and I'm not taking that out of the family travel budget or savings, that would be a nice little cushion, right? But I've exceeded that many times over in the 3 years that I've worked at OutSchool. So I definitely went into it with modest goals and exceeded them greatly, which was a nice surprise.
With a lot of these platforms that enable the side hustle, the Uber, the DoorDash, the Airbnb, they take a percentage. So if you were to fill a baking class, and I understand that would be about $1,000 in revenue, what would you then take home from that?
So if I fill a baking class, you are correct. One of my most popular classes is $1,000 when it's full. That's a 4-week class. And I take home $700 approximately from that. OutSchool takes 30% of all of our total enrollments.
And what would be in it for you now that you have developed that platform and that brand and that presence and that expertise? What's in it for you to stay with OutSchool versus going out on your own?
There's a number of reasons that I stay. The ironic one, right, is that OutSchool found you. So they target people who've got kids, right, and social media users and things like that. And I don't know the first thing about SEO. I can cover a cake in fondant in under 2 minutes, but search engine optimization, not my thing. And OutSchool has a whole team of people that are doing that for me. They're also taking payments and running customer service issues. There's an email address for support at OutSchool, safety at OutSchool, any concerns. There's a whole team of people that are managing that. And they're doing the technical side of things. I wouldn't have the first clue how to set up my website and deliver content and do all the things that they're managing for us. So from my perspective, the 30% is money well spent because I have a full support team. And essentially, it's like having a technical, an IT department and a finance department and all of this, and it's only costing me 30% of my income to have all that support staff.
How are they vetting the teachers that appear on that platform? You think about an Uber driver, they have to be vetted in some way. There's an ID check and all that stuff. What's the process like if someone wants to sign up to teach?
So OutSchool is a marketplace. It's an education marketplace. So you can take any idea that you've got basically and take it to OutSchool and see if it'll fly in the marketplace. So OutSchool isn't so much vetting your ideas, although they do, there is a class approval process, right? But they're going to kind of let the market determine what's going to sink or swim. But from a safety perspective, we have background checks that are done. There's only a certain number of countries that you can teach from. I think it's US, Canada, Australia, UK, because they have to be able to run background checks. And so depending on what country someone lives in, if they can't successfully go deep enough, then a person from that country would not be able to teach on the platform. And then our background checks are renewed every year. So I just did mine about 2 months ago. Go back in and they're looking for criminal history and all that kind of stuff. And safe to say I made the cut. So woohoo.
Right. You are in this great circumstance where your kids are homeschooled. So your job and your kids, it's all home-based. What do you think is going to happen post-pandemic? We ideally will return to a world in which we can shake other people's hands and go out in public to a movie one day. Do you think that will curtail the growth of the classes that you offer, or will the momentum continue?
Oh, I am counting the days till we can leave the house again. I think we'll see some drop off. We've already seen, at least I have seen, a little bit of a drop off this fall. In the spring, it was just mayhem, right? Because school ended on a moment's notice and the public schools obviously weren't set up for this. Who could be, right? It just was uncharted territory. And then over the summer, with so many kids home and not able to go to summer camp, it was mayhem part two. And this fall, even though a lot of kids are going to school virtually, the school system was more prepared for it. So we have seen a drop off in the fall with enrollments. But my enrollments are still up from what they were. And so I would assume that after the pandemic, it'll probably, there might be another little step down, but I think that we will retain a higher level of students than what we had pre-pandemic anyway, because so many people have discovered OutSchool, whether it's for tutoring or social clubs or things like that, or for little niche groups that they want to join. And so I'm hoping that a lot of learners stay and continue to enjoy with us.
Fascinating stuff. Megan, thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. I so appreciate you having me. This was fun.
Megan Tauber is one of the many, many, many teachers out there on OutSchool, a platform that allows students from, well, pretty much all over the world to engage in online learning in a pretty new and fun and interesting way.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
What goes up must come down, or maybe not, maybe not. If it's the stock market, what goes up must zigzag around and over and across and through and all over the place. My next guest says that trying to avoid the dips in the market might not be the best approach. Tom Bradley is chair and chief investment officer at Steady Hand Investment Funds. He joins us now to talk about how to prepare for a down market. Hello there, Tom.
Hi, Bruce.
You have been around for a long time in this industry, not like since the crash of 1929, but, you know, a long time.
Close.
What's the optimist's take on the down market that will come at some point?
The optimist take, well, I should say, first of all, that it will come. It's inevitable. The markets, as your intro implied, zigzag and go up and down. And sometimes the downs can be pretty bone jarring. So as investors, we're taking a great risk if we don't expect that the market will have its tough time. As I say to people, when they, for the money that they want to invest for the long term, when they put it in an investment account and they pick their stocks or their funds or whatever, they are signing up for future adversity. In other words, they are going to go through some periods where they wonder what they're doing, why they were doing it. So it is absolutely inevitable. But there is absolutely reasons to be optimistic about it, because a vast majority of investors are accumulating assets. And Bruce, I know you talk about this on the podcast many times, is you're putting money into your TFSA, your RSP, et cetera. And so when markets go down, it's like things going on sale. And most of us are great bargain hunters. We like to buy it, tell our friends about saving $1,000 on a car, talking the salesman down, or buying a blouse or a shirt on sale. But when it comes to investing, too often people sort of go running when things go on sale. So there's lots of reasons to be optimistic about it.
One of the challenges in the market versus, you know, when it's the price of a flat screen TV is we don't have the same innate understanding of the inherent value of the thing. So if the flat screen TV is on sale for 50% off and it's now only $300, you can kind of go, oh, well, yeah, that's a really good bargain. But when shares in Amazon or RBC or whatever company you're following decline, it's hard to intuitively know or even empirically know what the intrinsic value of that is to make the leap to say, ah, that is a bargain. How do you do that?
Well, no, it's a great question, because on an individual stock that, you know, goes down 30% or something, you don't know for sure that the whole outlook hasn't changed for that company, and it should be going down even more than 30%. But in the context of a diversified portfolio where you own a variety of different stocks in different industries and in different countries, et cetera, the evidence is overwhelming that over history, markets overreact. So that down 30 is not because the outlook for all those companies is 30% worse. It overreacts. And so that's why the market jumps around as much as it does, but it also is why it recovers consistently. And you've heard me use this expression, but if you look at a chart of your portfolio or the stock market, it goes up and to the right. And lots of, as we said earlier, zigs and zags along the way. Mm-hmm. So that is the trend that you want to ride. You don't want to fight against, because the trend over time is going the right way for you.
So there is a bunch of preparation that we've talked about in terms of the mindset. So you're, you know, preparing for it emotionally, and you're believing in this long-term trend that things will go up over time. You're getting bargains on maybe some high quality stocks. What about the math? How do you prepare mathematically? As in, is this a time when one should be sitting on some cash ready to deploy? How do you think that through?
Well, I think that question relates to who you are and what your goals are. You know, I think preparing for a younger investor, and I say young investor, anyone who's still got 10 years or more till retirement, or till they start to need the money they're accumulating, I think trying to time the market is folly. And so sitting on cash, yes, you might get it right sometimes, you'll miss other times. And my recommendation is get it invested and move on. Mm-hmm. For a retired, it's quite different. If the money is going to be spent to pay the bills or renovate a kitchen or something, then you have to think. And that's one of the things I think in preparing yourself for a downturn or a dip is be very crystal clear on the purpose of the money. And too often what we see is that people's sort of money they need to spend, that kitchen, I'll use the kitchen renovation example, creeps into being part of their investment portfolio, was set up for a very different reason. Longer term, can absorb the downturn, you know, retirement kind of savings. And so one of the things we tell people is be very, very clear on the purpose of your money, and make sure that shorter term money is needed in the shorter term doesn't creep into the long-term portfolio. The math that I think is really important too is we talk in percentages in our industry, and I think that is a very valuable way to assess how you're doing over time, your annualized rate of return. But one of the things we do, the steady hand, is with when we do risk management with people, they're deciding if they want to, say, have an all-stock portfolio, is we go back to dollars. You know, if you have a $500,000 portfolio, recognize that if the market goes down 20%, your 500 could go down to 400. Mm. You lose $100,000 on paper before it goes up to $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, $800,000. And I think that elicits the emotion out, so you start to appreciate how much risk you can handle through the dips.
A very easy way to avoid a stock market dip entirely is to have your entire portfolio in fixed income, which is a terrible idea if you're still in saving for retirement mode. But I wonder what the update would be in terms of the broadest possible way of thinking about asset allocation. Because there was a time when you'd say, oh, you're 50, you need 50% in fixed income. But it seems like that rule of thumb was written when there was any return possible on fixed income. And these days it's so low. How are you thinking about the balance between those asset classes today?
Oh, Bruce, you're exactly right. I think the old rules of thumb have gone out the window, and it's because interest rates are near zero and are not even exceeding inflation. So you can't go and hide in the bond market, or you remember Canadian savings bonds way back. So there aren't very many clients, even in their elder years, that we don't have them at least 50% invested in stocks. And wow. I think you just, to get some return and to try and beat inflation, you have to do that. But we combine that with, as I said earlier, making sure that the money that's needed over the next year or two, we set some aside in what we call a spending reserve. And so that, and it might only earn 1 or 1.5 in a GIC or at the bank or in our money market fund. But I think that's the way we do it, is we make sure the short-term money's covered off, and which allows those retirees to have a little bit more money working for them with stocks. But the old rules of thumb just, you know, in this world just don't apply anymore.
Yeah. Tom, thanks for your insight today. I really appreciate it.
Good to talk to you again, Bruce. Thank you.
Tom Bradley, Chair and Chief Investment Officer at Steady Hand Investment Funds. We were talking about the preparation required for the inevitable down market. Is it tomorrow? Is it next week? Is it next year? Is it 5 years? No one knows, but you can do some things now to prepare. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, charitable giving trends for 2020. Sona Khosla from Benevity will be here. And later, year-end tax planning in these unprecedented times. John Waters from BMO Private Wealth will be our guest. If you have missed an episode of this show, you can download full episodes on any of the podcast platforms out there. You can go to the website, moolala.ca, and search for individual segments by guest, by topic, whatever it is. Please let us know what you think in reviews or send us an email to ask@moolala.ca.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
2020 will go down in history for many, many things. Most of them are crappy, really, but some of them are good. Let's grab one of the good things this year and we'll magnify it, we'll expand it, we'll turbocharge it. In some sectors, charitable giving has been strong. Now, some charities have been hit really, really hard and they've had to cut back programs and they've laid off staff. But others have done better than ever before. New data from a company called Benevity shows that more people donated through its platform than ever before, making it the most charitable year on record. Sona Khosla is the Vice President of Marketing at Benevity, and she joins us now to talk about some of the charitable giving trends for 2020. Hello there.
Hey, Bruce.
I think it's important for our listeners to understand the context here because the trends we're going to talk about are trends within the Benevity world, not in charity writ large. And there's lots of, you know, strengths and weaknesses as I outlined today. But give us the brief answer on the workplace giving programs that Benevity supports.
Absolutely. So we estimate that around 75% of companies have some form of employee engagement program that supports their employees in doing good and rewarding them for it. So whether that's donation matching, volunteering, taking positive action, learning pro-social behaviors, those are the kinds of programs that Benevity's technology powers. And we do that for some of the world's most iconic brands. So you might have heard of Microsoft and Google and Nike.
Nope, never
and
heard
Apple.
Of it. No, don't even know who any of those companies, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yes. So we work with such unknown... Yeah, unknown 600 companies to power these programs to engage their people in doing good. We work with about 25% of the Fortune 500, so a lot of large companies. And we have actually processed more than $6 billion in donations, 34 million hours of volunteering time, and 275,000 positive actions through our platform.
It's also relevant to mention to our listeners that Benevity is a Calgary-based company and a real point of pride for that city in Alberta and for the province in general.
Absolutely.
Tell us about some of the data that you have gleaned so far in 2020 and what it says about both charitable giving, like the dollars and cents of it, but also this idea of employee engagement in the world around them.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we took a look at our data back in about in October, November, what we noticed was that more people did more good despite a really tough economy and a lot of uncertainty globally. So our data showed that 51% more people donated through their employers' programs in 2020 versus the year previous. And those people actually gave 41% more dollars per donation. So again, more people did more good through their employers and gave more dollars. And interestingly, people actually gave more money in the first 9 months to charity in 2020 than they did in all of 2019. And that's significant because typically most people open up their wallets and donate to charities and, you know, close to the holiday season is kind of considered the charitable season or the giving season. So that was pretty significant. So you know, why is that? Well, we definitely saw a huge uptick of the number of people who were taking positive action in the face of COVID-19. So for example, 250% increase in positive actions were logged through our platform than were last year. And this included things like, you know, helping your neighbors who maybe couldn't go out and get groceries themselves, mm-hmm. or calling elderly folks who are suffering under social isolation. So really meaningful and positive ways that companies were engaging their people. And I think, Bruce, you asked, you know, what this means for employee engagement, you know, and this was, I think, companies really recognizing that they had this opportunity to lean in at a time when the world was in crisis. Their people were undergoing a massive amount of change, a lot of them starting to work from home, feeling that sense of isolation, but also seeing a world in need. And so companies really stepped up and provided these incredible campaigns and opportunities for people to get involved through virtual volunteering, so they could be, you know, still physically distanced, but volunteering from home, or rewarding these positive actions, or teaching them, you know, hand washing at the very beginning of COVID that feels like ages ago, and rewarding them with charitable currency that they could donate to nonprofits, recognizing that nonprofits were having a really tough time completely pivoting their models.
I want to ask you about this idea of positive actions. You use the phrase, it is something that you track. What counts as a positive action, and how do you go about tracking it?
Yeah, that's a great question. So positive actions are things you do every day that are in support of your well-being or your community's well-being or other people. So for example, you know, we had people who were, so in the COVID context, people who were learning how to make sure that they were properly washing their hands or properly wearing their masks or properly physical distancing, recognizing that that keeps people safe and communities safe. But it's also things like environmental actions. So, you know, what does it look like if you ride your bike to work versus commuting by car? And then what we do is we help people track those activities in our platform. And they can then track what their individual impact is, whether through its reduced emissions or just doing good. And then some companies reward their people for hitting certain thresholds with charitable currency that they can then donate to the nonprofit of their choice. So it's kind of, it's actually been described as, by Rachel Notley, who was the former premier of Alberta. She once said, oh, it's kind of like the Fitbit of doing good. And that's not a bad description, actually.
We are in an extraordinary time. It's not over yet, but we are all hoping that soon parts of this pandemic phase will 100% be over, like we'll actually be able to leave our houses and hug our parents again. As you think about the charitable engagement, and I mean that in the broadest sense, time, talent, and treasure, what do you think we will look back and say, oh, that was like a temporary thing. We couldn't leave our house. That was temporary. Our engagement in charity in that way was temporary. And what is a systemic change in how we engage in the world around us?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, I think that, and I also hope that we don't return to normal on many fronts. I do want to hug my parents, but there were a lot of kind of systemic fractures in our society that really got highlighted through COVID and through the protests, you know, after the murder of George Floyd. And, you know, that brought into sharp focus major issues like around the need for good education and remote education, the need for food security, the need for equity for everyone. And so I hope that as we move forward, we don't lose sight of these things. We can definitely, you know, we're definitely a reactive society. When things are right in front of us, we tend to respond. But I hope that we will carry on some sustained awareness and action. Hopefully, we've developed some behaviors in terms of thinking more collectively, more globally, more inclusively, and that we carry forward. I think the other thing is we saw a lot of companies really stepping up and filling in this vacuum to support those most vulnerable communities. And so we just saw a record number of companies getting engaged and activating their networks, whether it was their employees or their customers. And so I think that is not going to go away. Every year I say, this is the watershed moment for companies embracing corporate purpose. And I think I've been saying that for the 5 years that I've been with Benevity, but it just keeps growing and growing and growing. And so I think that is definitely something that will not go away. We'll see more kinds of businesses, more sizes of businesses, and more businesses across geographies embracing their role in promoting a better world for everyone.
Really interesting stuff. Sona, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Bruce.
Sona Kosla, the Vice President of Marketing at a company called Benevity. If you haven't heard of it yet, you will hear of it soon. It's based in Alberta, serves clients around the world, and helps employees and companies kind of work together in making positive change around the world. All right, stay with us. Coming up next on the program, building a do-it-yourself stock portfolio. Ryan Irvin from Keystone is going to take us through the basics with a bit of a modern twist. And later, Megan Tauber from OutSchool, she will be back to take the Moolah La questionnaire. We have a newsletter to keep you up to date on all things Moolah La. It is once a month, and it is very simple. It just brings together stuff I've done on CBC Radio and CityLine and BNN Bloomberg and this show. And so if you'd like to sign up for that, hooray. Moolahla.ca is the place to do that.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
My first book came out 10 years ago. 10 years ago. It's ridiculous. I still look exactly the same as my author shot from 10 years ago. But one of the big things that I wrote about was how easy it is to create a simple, diversified, low-cost portfolio. It really actually is quite easy. It is a conversation that we need to have again and again and again and again and again. So we're having it again, this time with Ryan Irvin. He is the founder and CEO of Keystone, and he joins us now to share his DIY portfolio creation approach. Hello there.
Great to be on. Great to talk to you, Bruce.
What are the benefits of building a do-it-yourself stock portfolio?
Well, I think you can take control, you can save money over time, and you can build your wealth easier, and you can do it in a way that allows you that control that we all need today in a world that we see a lack of control. There's two things that we focus on: the composition, what you put in your portfolio, and the construction. So the two C's, how you build your portfolio. The composition is really the key element there. That's why at Keystone, we look at literally 3,500 companies in Canada twice a year and 3,000 in the US just to buy or find 15 to 25 stocks in a year for our clients. Now, why do we do this? Beside the fact that we have nothing else to do in a pandemic, equities are by far the most important element of your portfolio. Over 50% of traditional Canadian portfolios go into equities or stocks. Identifying great businesses that pay grow their dividends and pay dividends over the long term is the best way to grow your wealth. Often we like to identify unique businesses that you rarely hear about from traditional financial advisors. Now, Bruce, I hate to put you on the spot, but can I ask you a question? Can I do that? Sure. Mm-hmm. Do you know the best performing stock in Canada over the past decade?
I do not know the answer to that. No, but I don't know the answer to that question. I'm going to guess Shopify.
Perhaps over this decade, you may be right there. It's a great guess, but it's actually a little known company called the Boyd Group. What do? All they do is consolidate automobile repair shops. Pretty boring stuff, right? But the returns have been anything but boring. We recommended this stock in 2008. At $2.30. It trades today at $225.
Wow.
You don't hear much about that company, but it's gone up 9,000% in your portfolio. So when I talk about portfolio composition, adding just one Boyd, and this is obviously the best case scenario, but one company like this to your portfolio 10 years ago would have made a monumental difference in your portfolio. So this is why we go through so many companies to identify those high quality businesses, growing their dividends over time, like the Boyds of the world, and adding 15 to 25 of those that have a profile of good solid growth, good solid earnings, and growing their dividends over time. That is something that you don't typically see with your traditional financial advisor. When you go to your traditional financial advisor, what do you get? You plunk down your information with that advisor and they spit out a mix of 5 to 10 ETFs or mutual funds. For us, that's a huge structural problem. According to more modern portfolio theory, you're going to come close to diversification in a portfolio after just adding 20 stocks. So you get no benefit from adding any more stocks. When you look at an ETF or an individual mutual fund, all of those typically own 100 plus stocks. So if you buy 5 or 10 of those funds, all you've accomplished is a portfolio that mirrors the market. It is the market. And you underperform due to those ridiculous fees that they're charging you. So there is a better way to do it, we believe. And you can start just getting a discount brokerage.
Sorry, 15 to 25 stocks, you say. Why is that? Why is that the right number, do you think?
Well, I mean, because you don't get any diversification past 20 if you look at modern portfolio theory. Now, right.
So at the high end, you're in diminishing returns on diversification. But if you only chose three, you wouldn't have enough diversification.
Very, very right. That is on the low end, 2 to 3 stocks would be too much what we'd call company specific risk. An extreme example of that would be, say, if you held Tesla as one of the 2 or 3 stocks that you own. It's really a CEO driven company, Elon Musk. Now, heaven forbid he were to pass away. That would have a dramatic negative effect on the stock likely. You can mitigate that company specific risk out if Tesla is 1 or 2 or 3 companies in your portfolio. You cannot mitigate that, sorry. But if it is 1 of 20, you can handle it. You can help allay that company specific risk. That's why you don't go to 2 to 3. You don't go to 50 or 100. You just got a fee heavy portfolio that mirrors the market. The sweet spot there is between 15 and 25 stocks. And it's key to build that over a 12 to 24 month period. Don't go into the market and buy those 15 or 25 stocks at one given point. That would expose you to a short-term market correction. Build that over time. It'll allow you flexibility to add positions as new opportunities and new research comes available. So if you were going to start this DIY journey today, I would start with, and what we suggest to our clients is 3 to 5 initial purchases in the first 2 to 3 months, then every quarter or 3 to 4 months after that, adding 2 to 3 new positions as new information and research from us or any trusted advisor you have out there is released. And that's how you build a portfolio gradually over time.
When do you sell? How can you tell when it's time to sell?
It's the exact same process as you look to buy. We look at the fundamentals underlying the business. If the company has outstretched its growth prospects, it is too expensive essentially, then you sell. You don't always have to sell your full position. You can sell a half position. We've had many times where we love the business. We think it's not as fairly valued as when we originally recommended it. And we might want to take half our position out. You take your initial, if it's gone up, say 100% over a couple of years, you've done tremendously well. Take half your position out. You've taken your initial capital risk out of the business and you can let the rest kind of ride in a great company that may have good growth prospects, but is not trading at the same levels as when you originally bought it.
Now, just before you go, your view is predicated on a belief that one can and should exceed the index. Not everybody shares that belief. A lot of people believe, listen, if I just get the performance of the index in a low-cost, diversified world, I'm still hitting a home run because 90% of Canadians aren't even doing that.
Agreed. The best way to do that is if you want to do it. And we say for clients, you know, we have clients from that have portfolios of 20,000 up to 20 million. If you have 20,000 or under, we think individual stocks likely aren't for you to start. A basic portfolio of 3 low-cost ETFs, like 33% in a portfolio basic ETF of Canadian markets that mirrors the Canadian markets, 33% in a US ETF, and 33% in international ETF. A great way to mirror the markets on a shoestring budget, great way to start. I would advocate a portfolio like that. But if you want to try to beat the market, you got to do something different. And that is where our approach comes.
Interesting. Ryan, thanks for your time today.
Have a great day, Bruce. Thank you.
Ryan Irvin is the founder and CEO of Keystone. He joined us to talk about his company's do-it-yourself approach. It was stocks. It was individual stocks. And he says the number is somewhere between 15 and 25. Stay with us. Coming up next, how receiving federal pandemic relief benefits might impact your tax planning this year. John Waters from BMO Private Wealth is our guest. Then we take Megan Tauber from OutSchool through the Moolala questionnaire. Listen, I am a big fan of books on personal finance. There are so many. Now is a great time to hit your local library, hit your local bookseller, and pick up one or two. If I throw mine into the mix, the first one's called Moolala, Why Smart People Do Dumb Things With Their Money and What You Can Do About It. But it's one of many. If you go on our website and listen to some of our prior episodes, you will hear lots of conversations with extraordinary personal finance authors.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Tax planning looks a little different this year. A lot of stuff looks a little different this year. Many Canadians are going to have to consider how to factor in the fact that they have received federal pandemic relief benefits and how that's going to affect their filing. John Waters is the Vice President and Director of Tax Consulting Services for BMO Private Wealth. He joins me now to talk about some tax planning tips.
Hello, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. Many people have been on the receiving end of government benefits over the course of the last year for good reason. Tell us about how that will affect tax planning this year.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an important consideration this year, especially obviously with the pandemic relief. Probably the main program that people are aware of is the Canada Emergency Response Benefit. So this is, of course, for people that stopped working because of COVID. Maybe they lost a job, they were sick or quarantined or forced to stay home, look after kids who were not going to school, things like that. So those amounts, you could receive up to $500 per week for 28 weeks during March to September. And the key thing to remember with this is that this amount is taxable. And so CRA is going to issue you a tax slip for 2020 that you would have to include when filing your tax return. But the one other thing to remember is that unlike employment income, when these amounts were received, there was no tax withheld at source. So depending on the marginal tax rate, which of course is a function of other sources of income and deductions and credits, you may actually owe tax when you file your return in April on these amounts. So I guess the key message is to start thinking about that now, start planning for that. And if you do need to put money aside to pay for that tax, good idea just to be prepared.
There were some additional programs announced later in the year, and the government had the foresight to withhold some tax on the Canada Recovery Benefit. That's the one for principally, you know, gig economy workers and people who wouldn't qualify for traditional EI. Tell us about those and how the tax treatment will work.
Yeah, so much the same as the CERB. And that, as you pointed out, that program was largely to replace the CERB when it ended for people especially that weren't eligible for EI. So it's much like the CERB, but the main difference, there will be tax withheld, or there is being taxed withheld on those payments, but the rate is only at 10%. So again, a relatively small amount, and your tax rate may ultimately exceed that. So again, for any amounts that you receive for 2020, there may be some additional tax owing when you file in the new year.
People who were collecting those benefits were not flush, almost without exception. And if they weren't able to get their feet back under them financially, they could well be in a position where they can't repay the tax that is now required on the CERB in particular. Take us through what happens. So you file your taxes, there is tax owing, and there just isn't money available to pay. What should people do next?
Well, I think it's largely working with the CRA to come up with some sort of a payment plan. And I think you do identify a good point there, because the thing with the CERB especially was that it was very easy to get. Very simply go online and apply for it or over the phone. And there wasn't a lot of checks and balances up front. The government's focus was getting the money out to Canadians, especially early when they needed it. It was also available from two different sources, from the CRA, Service Canada. And of course, there was restrictions on how much other income you could earn before that would be clawed back. So I think a lot of people might be in for a bit of a surprise, because they might not actually have met the eligibility criteria to receive these amounts. So the government is going through right now and asking some questions and doing some reviews of the amounts that were paid out, particularly under the CERB. And they've also instructed people that, you know, maybe looking at the records now, planning for next year, and looking at the criteria, think, oh, you know, maybe I didn't meet the eligibility criteria. Maybe I need to pay that back. So the government is guiding people to actually let them know before the end of the year. And that way they won't report those amounts on the tax slips. Alternatively, of course, they'll have the review programs and ultimately sort that out in the longer run. But again, something to be aware of and to plan for.
You have been working in the tax area for a couple of decades. What are some of the other big things that people should be thinking about in terms of preparation? Obviously, they can't do the whole thing. There's, you know, T3s, T4s, T-whatevers to arrive in the mail come the new year. But what are some things that people can do to get themselves set?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've always taken the perspective, and what we're talking to when we're talking to our clients, we're saying, you know, tax planning is really a year-round process. I mean, we're all used to sitting down in March and April and doing our taxes. And, you know, for most people, that's the only time of the year, other than for tax people like myself, that are thinking about tax in March and April. But really, the message that we have is, you know, it's a year-round process. And especially towards the end of the year, because, you know, that the end of the calendar year is the end of the tax year. And so in terms of any deductions or credits that we'd want to apply when we file our tax return, we'd have to have those in before the end of the year. So some other things to think about, obviously tax loss selling is a popular one. And this is in a scenario when you've maybe realized capital gains earlier in the year. And you look around at your investments and you think some are down and maybe, well, if I sold these, I could realize a capital loss and that would offset the capital gains that I've realized earlier in the year. Or perhaps if it's a net capital loss, carry it back to a future year to collect some tax on net capital gains in prior years. But the critical thing there is it should be focused primarily on the investment choice. And because you can't actually go in and buy that security that you sold at a loss until 30 days after. So it's critical that you're focusing on the investment perspective. But other things like, as they say, making charitable donations, medical expenses, childcare expenses, all those sorts of things need to be paid in the calendar year. For someone that's turning age 71, it's important to realize that their RSP has to be wrapped up before the end of the year, December 31st. So there may be some planning there and final contributions to make and things like that.
The charitable dynamic is really important now, perhaps more than any time in recent memory. What's your TV commercial for people making a contribution before year end? What's in it for them? I mean, they get the feel good of making a difference. What's in it for them from a tax perspective?
In terms of charitable donations, so obviously the tax receipt for any donations over $200, you'll receive tax savings at the highest rate, or actually the second highest rate, depending on your level of income. But it can work out to about 45 or 50 cents on the dollar. So certainly there's an incentive from a tax perspective. And I would also mention that for people that have a non-registered investment portfolio, there's the ability to donate securities, publicly traded securities, and if they've increased in value when you donate them, it's really treated as a sale or disposition of that security, which would normally trigger a capital gain. But in this situation, because of a tax incentive, you actually can eliminate the capital gain, the tax thereon, and still get the benefit of that donation receipt for the fair market value of those securities.
John, thank you for your insight today.
My pleasure, Bruce. Great to speak with you again.
John Waters, Vice President and Director of Tax Consulting Services for BMO Private Wealth. He argues that tax planning is a year-round process. That phrase makes me want to grab a bottle of whiskey and cry silently into my sleeve. So instead, how about we have it be a process that you either give to the professionals or focus on with great interest when the time is right. And now is that time. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. So this is our series of questions about money, about life, about outlook. Megan Tauber is a teacher with OutSchool, which is this online learning platform that obviously became huge, especially in the beginning of the pandemic. And she is our guest today. Megan, I want to ask you first how you would describe your money personality.
I am a competitive person, and that spills over into my money personality. I've always set goals and tried to achieve them. I am a saver, and I am not a fan of debt. Debt makes me too anxious to sleep at night, so I avoid it at all costs.
Who was your money mentor growing up?
Ooh, I don't know if I had a money mentor growing up. I would think my parents, just because that was pretty much who I saw. And they were always making smart financial decisions. And so hopefully I have done them proud to follow in their
footsteps. Is there anything you rebelled against? You're like, no, I am buying fresh Ziploc bags. They are single-use products. I am not rinsing them out. Oh, sorry. Was I projecting there? I think I might have been projecting my own childhood.
Let's see. Anything I rebelled against? I don't think so. I don't tend to live with a lot of regrets. So if I want something, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it with my whole heart.
Yeah. What is one of your spending pleasures?
Oh, spending pleasures has to be a housekeeper, right? I am a household of seven who, as you mentioned earlier, we are home. My husband works from home. And so my kids are homeschooled. I work from home. There are seven of us here all day traipsing in and out and eating and all sorts of stuff. So somebody to come in and hit the refresh button every once in a while is a guilty pleasure that I just have to have.
Now, did you in the pandemic, well, you were already fully positioned because you were already homeschooling. Were there any additional purchases that you made in that time? Like I would think about like noise canceling headphones with all those monsters crawling around the house at all times, but you were relatively used to that.
You know, there wasn't too much that we had to buy. Thankfully, my kids all had laptops. We were all pretty well set up, so that was good. The thing that we've spent money on during the pandemic that we wouldn't ordinarily are some things. And I say that because we're fairly minimalist. We're not thing people. We're more experience people. But it's been a year of no experiences, really, right? And so I did do some things. I bought my kids a 3D printer, for example, to continue their ability to explore and educate at home. Safely. And stuff like that, I probably wouldn't normally spend money on, but this has been quite a different year.
Yeah. Now, you historically have spent a fair part of your year traveling. You have an RV. How do you think about the, and I'm using air quotes here, the budget of that traveling part of your life?
Mm-hmm. So we do plan ahead quite a bit when we're about to set off in the RV. Because of my husband's work schedule, I travel a lot with the kids by myself. And so I know a lot of people are willing to hop in their RV and throw caution to the wind. And I don't really feel safe doing that since I'm by myself. And so I will plan out a route. I know approximately how many miles we're going to drive, where we're going to be staying. We stay in national parks and state parks a lot. They're the most beautiful places in our country, and they're dirt cheap to go and stay in and explore. So it's pretty easy to kind of budget that out. We'll plan, if we're going to spend the whole summer on the road, we'll plan out one or two big experiences, whitewater rafting in Montana or zip lining in Wyoming, right? And so I'll kind of budget that stuff in advance. And we do pretty good staying on track. We don't really eat out a lot when we travel. We've got a kitchen on wheels, so we're good.
Most parents, me included, outsource most of their child's education to another teacher in another building, at another time. They're not doing that kind of work at home. As a homeschooler, you are overseeing all of it. Where does financial literacy play out in their education? Is it something that you put your eye on? Is it organic as you talk about, you know, world history and the stock market crash of 1929? Or how do you think about that?
I would say it's exceptionally organic. And it's a huge part of what we do in our home so that our kids are prepared to go out and live in the real world. We've talked from day one about college debt and you know, leaving college with $100,000 in debt is not an option, right? That there's other ways to achieve a college degree if that's your path. But one of the ways that we've done it is two of my three kids are what we call kidpreneurs, right? My daughter is a fiber artist, and she has done business fairs and done all sorts of stuff all over the place. So she's got her own little green light card that she can use to manage her money. She's got accounts. She actually at one point proactively switched all her money to an account that would yield her higher savings, right? She approached us and said, hey, can I do this, right? And so they've learned through their passions, and they've learned through doing, which has been an easy way to teach because you're not trying to cram something down their throat. They're fully invested when it's something that they're passionate about.
Sure. Okay, another air quotes here. When do you plan to air quote retire, and what will you do?
I would love to travel when I do retire. It's an interesting concept. I could retire anytime. So I might be in a different position because this is a side hustle. I don't technically need to work. I work for travel and fun and budget money to be able to go and have great adventures. So if I wanted to stop working tomorrow, I technically could. My husband has an amazing job. But I don't see myself retiring anytime soon, perhaps when my kids leave the house, right? I've got about 10 years-ish until they potentially go off and spread their wings. So maybe at that time I would retire and just kind of take a break.
Yeah, you drive around in the RV and camp outside their dorm room. That's what you're doing.
I could do that, right?
Asking if they need any help with homework because mama's got, you know, some bacon in the oven and swing on by.
I've got experience with homework.
Yeah, that's right. One last question here. If you listen, it's not just an American phenomenon. It's a Canadian one too. People are in debt over their heads. Mm-hmm. If you were going to tackle that issue from your perspective as a homeschooler and as an out-school baking and history instructor, what do you think is the single most important thing that would enable people to reduce their reliance on debt?
I think it would boil down to me to a spreadsheet, right? Like, get everything on paper. How do you begin to tackle debt until you know exactly where the money's going, exactly what's coming in, where's it going, what can be cut, what can't be cut, and then you can begin to really figure out what's happening. We had credit card debt a number of years ago from the 2008 financial crash. My husband lost his job, and so I was using an American Express card to pay the power bill, right? We had literally bought a house 3 weeks before he lost his job. Yeah, and we hadn't sold the prior one yet, which shouldn't have been a problem in a typical Florida real estate market. Houses sell pretty quickly, except we literally bought a house the month the bubble burst. And so we were in a real pickle and we had built up some debt. And I had followed Susie Orman's advice, which was pay off everything with a high interest rate first and just work your way down, right? And there was a spreadsheet and there was a plan and off it went. You know, it took some time and it wasn't fun, but the ease of which laying my head down on a pillow at night once it was gone was much better.
I believe it. Megan, you may now lay your head down on a pillow again because your job here is done. Thank you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Megan Tauber for the Moolala questionnaire. Megan was on the show today to talk about her experience as an educator with a e-learning platform called OutSchool. That is our show for today. If you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, subscribe to our newsletter. You can find that subscription, I don't know, button or whatever at moolala.ca. Another great thing to subscribe to is the podcast version of this show. While you're there, leave us a review. And if you've got thoughts or story ideas or questions, the email address is ask@moolala.ca. On social, I'm at Bruce Selry on Twitter, Bruce Selry Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.